Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Dr. Graham T. Clues. Dr. Clues, a teacher now retired, he is the author of Churchill's Dilemma, the real story behind the 1915 Dardanelles campaign. And today we are discussing with him his latest book, Churchill's Phony War, a Study in Policy and Frustration, published by the Naval Institute Press. Welcome, Dr. Clues.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me onto your show.
Dr. Clues, what is, in essence, the thesis of your book?
Well, look, it strikes me, I say broadly, it's suggesting that, when people have written in the past and explored the phony war period, they've tended to do it from a point of view that Churchill was either quite extraordinary or he's quite dreadful, and I've tended to take a middle position and argue that he was a mixture of both. He did some things really well and some things indifferently and potentially disastrously.
Now, in the book, there is an extended discussion at the beginning of it of a U-boat controversy about numbers of U-boats sunk by the British in the fall of 1939. And in essence, there was a dispute between Churchill as First Lord of the Admiralty and the Director of Naval Intelligence. Can you go into a little bit of that controversy, obviously closely wrapped in secrecy at the time, how would you evaluate Churchill's behavior in that particular instance?
It's Churchill ultimately asserted remarkable success in sinking of the U-boats, attacking and sinking them. He was making claims for the sinking of U-boats that were quite inconsistent with the facts, and that was something to which Admiral Godfrey took exception, and he felt that he was overstating things. Churchill, I think, did not believe he was doing so. And this went on for most of the phony war. And eventually, as you will know, having read it, that eventually he instituted an inquiry in mid-1940 to establish exactly the circumstances. And it transpired that Godfrey was, and his more conservative approach to the assessment of U-boat sinkings, was much closer to the mark than Churchill. Now, Churchill's accused of doing this fairly calculatedly, and I put forward the proposition that and argued the case that he had good cause to believe that Britain was doing remarkably well against the U-boats in 39 and early 40 while he was First Lord. And I expand on that in the chapter and indicate that he was, well, he was certainly wrong. I mean, and on a number of levels, not only was he wrong on the assessment of how many U-boats were sunk, but he had these extraordinary calculations and estimates of how many were being attacked and then damaged either seriously or partly. The reality was that very few U-boats were being found and very few were being attacked throughout the Phoney War. But this information was information that he was being supplied by the anti-submarine warfare division. So he wasn't making this stuff up. He was being given this information and he applied it somewhat injudiciously.
Now, to go back a little bit, it is well known that upon Churchill's return to the Admiralty, there was a famous cable which went out, quote, "Winston is back," which, at least to the uninitiated, gives the appearance of the sort of the Ancient Mariner returning to home. Is that, in fact, a good description of the Admiralty staff's initial relations or response to Churchill's return to the Admiralty, or was it a little bit more ambiguous?
Well, my first comment is that, as much as I've read on this, is that that a claim about the Winston is back is somewhat dubious. I'm not actually sure that it actually occurred. But putting that to one side, what did the Admiralty think of him? I think it's very difficult to actually tell. I think they respected his the things he could do for the Navy. He was fairly aggressive in outlook and so on, but he had his own views on things, and he quickly found himself at odds with Pound, for example, on Pound and Phillips, Admiral Pound and Admiral Phillips on naval construction. And, of course, he had this notion of an attempt to break into the Baltic. This was called Operation Catherine. So it was, but you when you read comments from Pound and others, they do acknowledge his strengths, but I think they're fully aware of his weaknesses as well. So, look, I would think it'd be fair to say that with most things, there were mixed attitudes. He was a very, very strong personality. He had very distinct views on things, and they were not always shared by the Admiralty itself.
Can you go in a little bit and describe what you just mentioned, Operation Catherine, Churchill's British naval incursion into the Baltic Sea, and why the Admiralty staff, particularly Admiral Sir Dudley Pound, why he was vociferously opposed to it?
Well, the idea of an incursion into the Baltic goes right back to the First World War, and indeed even before that, and he put forward this proposal in 1915 and then again later in the war. He was disappointed. I think there's no doubt he was disappointed that it had not taken place, and I think he wrote as much in his history of the First World War. And he mentioned, he addressed this plan again in early 39, before the outbreak of the war. He thought this was another way of applying pressure to the Germans. high risk, of course, in 1939, 1940, because of the Air Force and the German air threat. And arguably that was the main reason why Pound resisted it. I mean, beyond that, you're talking about a Navy in 1939, 1940, which is a fraction of the Navy the British had in First World War. And I think many fewer battleships, and Churchill imagined that they had some surplus to need. But Pound and Phillips thought this was nonsense. Certainly the Germans had a fraction of their First World War fleet as well. But the issue was the British could have found themselves eventually in conflict with the Italians and the Japanese. And so the nation, there was a surplus of these battleships that could, several of which I think he was talking, writing of having three tried into the Baltic, was absurd. But more than that, it was the notion that they could stay there and indeed face the threat of German aircraft. Now, he proposed doing all sorts of things to make this viable, including adding armour to the decks and so on. But Pound was never really interested, and he put forward, he argued the case that it was only when they were it was very clear who they were up against, and there was really no way of knowing that for years ahead, that they would contemplate such a high-risk operation. And so he did his best to dampen it, and by January 1940, the operation was shelved. Churchill still kept it in mind and insisted that all the preparations that had already been made should be kept on standby for perhaps a similar operation in 1941, and it never came to pass for all sorts of reasons. And that was a blessing for everyone, no doubt.
What exactly is what you refer to in the book as, quote, cigar butt strategy, unquote?
That's, I believe, a Curly Barnett term, yes. Now, I suppose the way I would interpret it is fairly off-the-cuff kind of ideas that haven't been given a great deal of thought. And certainly that's my interpretation of what Barnett meant. And Churchill did a lot of that sort of stuff. And people constantly had to sort of tie him down and find ways of means of distracting him. And Pound was quite good at that, I think. And Pound would speak his mind. I believe some people say that Pound was, I think Roscoff was an example who argued that Pound was quite soft. I thought he stood his ground, and certainly the evidence of what I read, he stood his ground on any issue he considered important. He was mindful of the fact, though, that you just didn't tackle Churchill directly. You know, you would try and distract him. And you often see that in a lot of the writing, that, he comes up with an idea, you distract him with other things, and that idea is shelved. Though, ironically, he was extraordinarily persistent with Catherine through September through to December. And that's because of the political developments as well, which actually, for a period of time, gave him greater cause to think that, this could really make a difference, because as you would know, there was a great focus from late 1939, on separating Germany from Swedish oil supply, and he imagined that Operation Catherine could help in some way to achieve that. So that gave him cause to keep on pushing this plan, and Pound had to work particularly hard at trying to distract him on that one.
Churchill and his appreciation of the building requirements of the Admiralty seems unusually sensitive to extra naval considerations of strategy. What do you attribute this unique point of view to?
I'm going to have to ask you to clarify what you mean by the question.
What I meant was extra naval considerations of strategy. Why was Churchill more than unusually sensitive to aspects of the war strategy which went beyond his particular department? In the book, you relate that, counterintuitively, of course, that he was very sensitive to the need to not overbuild, and therefore, and again, this is very unusual for any First Lord of the Admiralty at any period of time, I presume, that he cut down on the building requirements for the Admiralty in terms of battleships, aircraft carriers, cruisers, destroyers, etc. What do you attribute this peculiar, seemingly peculiar policy point of view?
Yes, and I understand where you're coming from on that one. Yes, it's unusual. You would expect a First Lord, as you would expect a Secretary of State for Air or War, to be really pushing their own portfolio. But Churchill came in with a big picture approach, and he felt that you know, the Navy had to live within means, and as did the Air Force and the Army. And he thought that the Royal Navy was quite well served. He thought it generally had requirements sufficient to needs. Of course, he recognised that the real focus needed to be on small craft to deal with the anti-U-boat campaign, which he anticipated to get become quite significant as time went on, though he imagined it would be nothing like that at the First World War. So yes, it was very much a big picture view, and he just took the approach that you know, he was more than a First Lord, and he stuck his nose into everybody's business as a member of the War Cabinet, much to the chagrin of other War Cabinet members. And it was an unusual thing, but I think it goes back to his experience of the First World War, where he was not only First Lord, but later in the war, he was involved in dealing with munitions and so on. And I think he felt during the First World War that the Navy had demanded more than its due, and then had done so little with it. The Navy was a vast instrument at the end of the First World War, but I think he looked back with a sense that, well, what did it do? What did it achieve with its vast fleet of battleships and so on? And of course, the argument, of course, was it was a fleet in being, but Churchill's aggressive instincts really required that it be put to use, and it wasn't. In the Second World War, I think that was influential to some degree, but beyond that, he had a very intense focus, and this is something that becomes quite obvious when you read what he was doing in the early parts of the war. He had this focus on the first year or so of the war, that money needed to be spent in a way that helped Britain avoid being defeated. It was investing on distant projects, and of course, battleships, for example, are a very long-term operation, and you're talking 3 or 4 years to build them. And to Churchill's mind, well, while these are being built, we could be defeated or seriously compromised by not having the things that we need more immediately. And that included, of course, a larger army, which was quite small at the start of the war. So he had a very strong short-term focus, and that influenced his attitude to naval construction, and it put him at odds with Pound and Phillips, who both thought in mind of a futurist, including that of war with Japan. And so it was a major sticking point between the three of them.
How did Churchill, in fact, differ in his views of the potential threat from Japan and Italy from Sir Dudley Pound and Admiral Phillips?
Well, I argue that he thought in terms of, you know, if Britain took action and acted in a way that kept the German threat under control, the others wouldn't develop. And so the focus again was, along with the French, to limit that threat. And the Japanese and the Italians would take advantage of any success the Germans had. So if you could deny the Germans success at whatever level, the other two threats wouldn't develop. And I think to that extent he was correct. So he rather than invest money and resources into longer term threats, and Pound and Phillips and the Navy more generally always maintain that focus. So, look, we want to come out. We want to come out at the end of this war strong enough to deal with other threats. And Churchill said, "Well, no, we've got to deal with this one first. You know, if we don't deal with this one, none of that will really matter. And moreover, if we deal with Germany successfully, then the others won't arise." And that was quite a different approach.
How would you describe Churchill's initial behavior in the war cabin in the fall of 1939? Could he have been accused of intriguing?
I think my sense of Churchill throughout the entire period was that he was very loyal. He was a very professional member of the war cabinet. He had a big picture approach to things, and he certainly stepped beyond his own portfolio, and he dabbled in anything and everything. And as I've indicated, that tended to upset his colleagues. But I can't think of an occasion or an example where you would suggest he was intriguing. Are you just talking in terms of intriguing against Chamberlain, for example? No, my sense, I think, Jenna, and unless there's something that you've read in my book that gives you cause to believe otherwise, no, I think he was a very loyal member of the war cabinet, and you know, he committed to Chamberlain very early on, and I think he remained that way for most of the phony war. Until the very, very, well, I think throughout, I think he did the right thing with Churchill, with Chamberlain rather. And the big thing with Churchill was that he took a big picture approach, and he quite happily interfered with anything and everything, which is something we've already talked about. He tried to adopt a holistic approach. He took on board the needs of the Air Force, the needs of the Army, and as you've already identified, he was prepared to compromise money spent on the Navy as well. So no, I don't see that he was an intriguer at all. And this is obviously part of the historiography of the period. I think there are those who were quite... I think the suggestion was, yes, even if he was not doing much himself, he was more than content for his supporters to be doing things behind the scenes. But No, I don't see much evidence of that.
So in essence, he was playing with a straight bat.
I think so, yes. I think he was, in many respects, very relieved to be part of the cabinet. He immersed himself in his responsibilities. He certainly did push his own agenda, and that agenda was to be as aggressive as he possibly could with the Royal Navy, and that was the source of the only thing open to the government at the time for aggressive action against the Germans. He was a very busy, engaged member of the War Cabinet, and I think he was playing with the straight bats throughout, yes.
Did Churchill's view of strategy and the UK's strategic options differ markedly from those of the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax?
I think there's an assumption, there's an underlying assumption in many works that, yes, he was quite determined. He wanted to take the fight to the Germans and be much more aggressive than either Chamberlain and Halifax and the cabinet more generally were prepared to be. I'm not persuaded by that. I mean, there's no doubt that he wanted to use the Royal Navy more aggressively, or parts of it, and that's what Operation Catherine was about. And he, as you know, he also proposed a modest plan to mine the Norwegian leads to force ships carrying oil to Germany out into international waters where they could be intercepted. But that's a comparatively small operation, which didn't actually take place until April the following year. No, I actually think by and large, he conformed to the Chamberlain view of which is essentially sit tight and rearm. Now, let's not engage too much in things, take advantage of whatever hiatus they get to rearm and rebuild, or not rebuild, but to build, because they were a long way behind the Germans in certain aspects. And I think that's at odds with the perspective taken by a lot of historians. Now, there's some controversy exists around his attitude to the use of air power. The argument being that he would like to be more aggressive in air, and I saw absolutely no evidence of that. He recognised that there are advantages in letting things proceed as they were. So no, he was certainly frustrated by lack of aggressive opportunities, and he pushed several proposals on the War Cabinet, which they were reluctant to adopt. But by and large, he conformed to the sit tight and rearm approach of Chamberlain, and on many occasions supported it quite publicly. And accepted that, every day the Germans were declined to be aggressive towards Britain was an opportunity for Britain to rearm and prepare.
What was the proposed Narvik operation, and why was Churchill in favour of it?
Well, as I've already indicated, the Narvik proposal was During the pre-war, most of Germany's ore came via the Galavar ore fields and one or two other ore fields in Sweden. And during the winter months, the Baltic freezes, and the ore therefore was shipped across Norway to the port of Narvik in northern Norway. And then from there was shipped down down through the Norwegian territorial waters to Germany. And Churchill's quite keen to intercept this oil for the obvious reason that it would deprive Germany of the oil needed for its war machine. Now, in late November 1939, the Ministry of Economic Warfare claimed that if they could actually cut this supply of oil to Germany, offer as little as 6 months, it could have a decisive difference on the war and perhaps lead to Germany's defeat. And this is, to my mind, a gross exaggeration, but Churchill ran with this idea and he put it before the war cabinet. But it didn't take off, and it took off. It failed to do so for this reason, that a couple of weeks later, the Minister of Economic Warfare came out and with a kind of amended approach to this, and they argued, well, in actual fact, it probably wouldn't do the harm we expect. If we really wanted to make a difference, we need to cut off all of Germany's oil supply from Sweden. That meant, of course, cutting off the supply through the Gulf of Bosnia during the summer months, once the Baltic had melted, Baltic ice had melted. Now that was a different operation. The question was, okay, Narvik's not going to work by itself. So, is there a way to also address the summer supply? And the notion came to pass in late November. In November 30th, the Russians invaded Finland. And as time went on, the idea was put forward that if Britain and France offered to help Finland, that would give them ultimately and potentially access to Sweden, and they could get control of the Galava oil fields and cut off both winter and summer supplies. And once you get a hold of the oil fields, that would be the end of the matter. Now, this is, for all sorts of reasons, an absurd proposition, but it was sufficient to stall the Narvik operation because the ocean was put forward. Well, the only way we're going to be able to get access to Sweden is if they seek our support, and they won't seek our support if we cut off this supply of oil via Narvik. So it essentially meant that the Narvik plan was suspended while this Finnish plan went forward, and in the end neither took place. I should correct that and say that the Narvik operation didn't occur until very early in April, and by that time it was very much too late. And of course, several days later, or indeed almost immediately, the Germans, by coincidence, launched Operation Wetterbrong and invaded Norway. But that's another story.
Why was the German invasion of Norway such a surprise, other than, I suppose, the non-availability at that time of ultra intercepts?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Interesting question. There were quite a few warnings that they had. In fact, the warnings given were remarkably precise and remarkably accurate. I mean, they were aware. They were made aware through intelligence that forces were going to head towards Narvik and occupy that port, and that's precisely what happened. It was remarkably precise, but it was assessed as being of dubious merit. And by the time they grasped that this was an actual fact occurring, it was too late. As for the movements of the ships themselves, well, no doubt weather played a part in concealing elements of the forces. But the ones that were moving towards Narvik were identified and were pursued, but they were some way ahead of the British forces. And those that, by coincidence, were about Narvik were, by a series of misfortunes, removed from a position of interception. And that was something I addressed in some detail in my book, exploring why it was that, despite the remarkable coincidence of events, that you've actually got this mining force, you've got four mining destroyers, and you've got four other destroyers in support, and you've got HMS Renown nearby, and you've got this force of German ships heading towards Narvik, and the opportunity was potentially there for a decisive victory, and so for one misfortune after another, that did not come to pass. And I address that in considerable detail and explain why this wonderful opportunity to have a decisive victory against the German forces failed to take place.
Can Churchill's actions or inactions in the Norway campaign be viewed in a more negative light than those of the Prime Minister or the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax?
Look, they all made mistakes. Errors of judgments were made for all sorts of reasons. But I think generally that Church was perhaps held more responsible than he ought to be, and Chamberlain and Halifax less so. And this is something that another historian, Chris Bell, addressed some years ago, and I've developed on that if you really dig a bit more deeply, you'll find that it's not Churchill that's pushing things, it's Chamberlain and Halifax, as you'd expect, really, encouraging and directing strategy. And then Churchill had to find a way to solve the problems that he faced. And he did that while he always tried to accommodate these things, and he was probably a bit too precipitate in the way he addressed these things. He tried to find solutions that ultimately failed to work. So should he be held more responsible than Chamberlain and Halifax? No, I don't think so. I mean, they made different errors of judgment for different reasons. The dynamics of the whole Norwegian campaign, the notion was always, leading prior to April 9th, which was the day on which the Germans entered Narvik, Trondheim, Bergen, Stavanger and Oslo in Norway, that any German forces could be preempted, at least along the west coast of places like Bergen, Trondheim and Narvik. It was just a general acceptance that with the Royal power of the Royal Navy and the appropriate levels of surveillance and so on, that these forces, German forces, could never occupy these ports. And for that reason, they wouldn't try. And they were wrong. They took this bold chance, and they all, for a variety of reasons, evaded the British forces that were available, and they occupied these ports. And from that point on, they were at an advantage. Churchill thought that they'd be able to turn things about quite rapidly, but that proved not to be the case for all sorts of reasons, perhaps the most important of which was German air power. So I think I've lost my train of thought on that one, but you might want to help me pick up on that one. But I think generally speaking, there are multiple reasons for the Germans to succeed and the British not to, and it's a mixture of responsibility. But if there's a sense that it's all Churchill's fault, that would not be true at all.
In your discussion of the Churchill-Chamberlain relationship circa April 1940, you would be correct to say that you differ from the views of, say, someone like Paul Addison, who in essence states that Chamberlain gave Churchill the chairmanship of the Military Coordination Committee because he in essence was blackmailed by Churchill, that Churchill had, as per Addison, had threatened to resign, and Chamberlain realized that if he did, the entire government would fall. So therefore, accordingly, he gave in to Churchill's ultimatum. Why do you disagree with that analysis?
Well, I think a couple of things is that Churchill was given the chairmanship of the Military Coordination Committee in early April. I don't think there's any hint there that was any kind of ultimatum involved. Now, I argue that, you know, that was not a particularly unreasonable, unsurprising, or surprising thing to do, because beginning of April, the two key initiatives, as far as the war was concerned, were ones that had stemmed from Churchill, and that's an operation against Narvik, but also an operation called Operation Royal Marine, which was a plan to seed the rivers and waterways of Germany with a floating mine. And I just felt it made sense to elevate Churchill to this position. The keeping in mind that the former chair, Chatfield, was in a peculiar situation, and he felt redundant. He felt that he couldn't persuade and influence, and I think eventually Chamberlain agreed. Now, there certainly was pressure during March and post the collapse of the Finnish option I think within the House to give Churchill greater influence. So it's always difficult to tell to what extent Chamberlain felt compelled to do this. But I argue that he was all the flip side, which is that he was always aware that Churchill was the most competent within his cabinet in terms of matters of war. And given that these were his initiatives that we're now pursuing, it made sense for him to be more responsible. That said, the position of chairman, certainly in the early parts of April, was not really a promotion at all. I mean, it didn't give Churchill any particular power. Now, I think what you might be referring to is the pressure that Churchill brought to bear in about the 23rd, 24th of April, when he had drafted a letter to Churchill saying, look, I don't really want to hold this role as chairman any further because it's responsibility without authority. That's an interesting dynamic there because on the one hand, Churchill's concerned that he was being required to make decisions or the part of decisions that he didn't agree with, but he would have to share the responsibility for. And I actually think that Chamberlain took a slightly different view. He actually felt that Churchill's part decisions that he could play no part in. And I think Churchill wanted to have greater influence and greater power, so the decisions being made were more in tune with what he thought was appropriate. And Chamberlain wanted to come up with a situation that would tie him more closely to the decisions that were being made, because if he wasn't able to disavow responsibility for them, then he would be more responsible in the choices he made. So I actually thought it was a coalescence of need with, I suppose, I think both parties thought there was merit in it. So I don't share that. There's a sense that Churchill was intimidating and threatening and pressured Chamberlain into this reluctantly. Now, there may have been an element of reluctance in giving Churchill unfettered power, and I think the track record of Churchill during the Phoney War tended to justify that. But a distinction needs to be made between just giving him carte blanche and saying, look, here we are, we'll give you all the authority you wish, and we will let you make all the decisions and so on, and giving him greater responsibility. And in the end, Churchill was given a greater role in the MCC. He was able to deal more directly with the chiefs of staff, and he was quite content with that. And it remains to be seen how well that would have worked. Churchill certainly was content with it, but in early May, you have the famous Norway debates, and on November, on May 10, you have a change of government. So, and Churchill becomes prime minister, and he deals even more directly with the chiefs of staff. So we don't really know how that would have worked. But no, I generally do not accept the notion that Chamberlain was being, threatened by Churchill's resignation. I think the relationship was much better than that.
How important was Lord Salisbury's watching committee to the downfall of Chamberlain in the May debate over the Norway campaign?
I don't profess to be an expert in all the ins and outs of those things, and their particular influence. I tend to take a slightly different view of the whole process and argue that the decision to resign was more Chamberlain's than it is accepted to be the case. I think the catalyst for change was that Chamberlain accepted that there had to be a national government. And indeed, as you know from reading the book, Churchill actually counselled after the infamous or famous May 9 and May 8th, May 7th and 8th debate, at the end of that, in the evening on the 8th, Churchill counselled Chamberlain to hang in there, rebuild the government, bring in the Liberals and so on. We can still go on. And Chamberlain was the one who had concluded that the change had to be made and that we had to advance with a national government. And if that couldn't be achieved with him, with Chamberlain as Prime Minister, and he'd resign. And that left the door open ultimately to Chamberlain, because Halifax simply wasn't interested. He did not wish to be the Prime Minister of Britain. And I'm sure there are those who argue that it was Labor's refusal to be part of a national government with Chamberlain as the Prime Minister that was a big influence. Others say that it was It was the fact that so few conservatives supported Churchill, Chamberlain, and some abstained, and so on. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that Chamberlain still had a majority, and quite a substantial one, and that he may well have been able to carry on, but he'd concluded that a national government was necessary. And it looked, it's pretty obvious, and certainly by the evening of the 9th, I think. Yes, the 9th, in the afternoon of the 9th, the famous meeting with Attlee and Greenwood and so on. And it was pretty, you know, they didn't say emphatically, but they said, look, you know, they indicated that the chances are of the Labor Party accepting him as Prime Minister was pretty slim. And Churchill, I think Chamberlain recognised that fact. And they decided that day that it was that afternoon. And in fact, they'd already decided before they had this meeting with Attlee that if Labor Party said no, then to Chamberlain continuing as Prime Minister, then Churchill would be put forward as the new leader. And that assumed, of course, I suppose, that Churchill was susceptible to the Labor Party. And as you know, if you've read the book, I think that was perhaps one of the most influential things in Churchill's mind, and why I argue that he was more supportive of Chamberlain than many people contend, was that, one, he didn't want Labor to be part of a government, and two, he perhaps worried that Labor would also say that, yes, well, we will be part of a government, but it can't include Churchill as well. And I think that's perhaps a slightly different perspective that's out there at the moment.
Overall, what is your assessment of Churchill's performance in the period in office during the phony war?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Churchill was always a mixture of strengths and weaknesses, and they were always fairly obvious, and they manifested again during September through to May. He did some things well and some things indifferently, and that's probably not surprising. My contention, though, is because there are those who would say, well, look, you know, how much better things would have been had Churchill been Prime Minister from the start of the war. I'm not convinced of that at all. I mean, I think you've got to look at the different dynamics of the time periods. The phony war was phony for reasons other than Britain not being more proactive and aggressive. Churchill was seeking ways to be more aggressive, and some of them were rather dubious propositions, and some, like the mining of Narvik, might have gone ahead, but it probably would have achieved very little. I think I, to some extent, argue that Chamberlain was the right man for the phony war, and Churchill was the right man from May 10 onwards. They had different strengths and different weaknesses. And I've also argued that I don't think all said and done that in many respects the phony war would have been much different under Churchill. And a particular point I develop is his attitude to air power and the use of the escalation of the air war. There's this sense that, or this notion that Churchill would have been much more aggressive against Germany in the air had he been Prime Minister. There's no evidence of that at all. In fact, I argue very strongly that he was, along with Chamberlain perhaps the most conservative about escalating the air war in the entire war cabinet. So, look, he was a man who I think his colleagues had cause to be worried about and cautious with. You know, he did some really and suggested some really silly things, and the notion, as I said, that if he'd been prime minister, that things would have been that much better is just extremely doubtful. And yes, I don't think it's beyond dispute that he made a very successful wartime prime minister, but whether he would have been the right man to have been running the country between September and May, September 1939 and May 1940 is another issue altogether. And this is the distinction. They're the right men for their times to some extent.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Well, that's a tough one. I think what I've tried to do is provide balance. Now, that's not been a mission so much as it's just the way in which the evidence that I discovered pointed me. I don't think there's any point in being anti-Chamberlain and pro-Churchill. I think you just weigh their performances on their merits. And I think the Churchill that I detail in my book is a mixture of strengths and weaknesses. And he was not a godsend. He was not a blessing. Absolutely. He had wonderful strength, you know, and there's no doubt his speeches were very important and his presence was very important. But within the war cabinet itself, he wasn't a resounding success. He was a mixture of, as I said, strengths and weaknesses. And so it's... I think it's important that we take this on board. I'm ultimately wonder if I'm... I think people crave heroes, and that's all well and good, but I think it's always good to acknowledge that even our heroes have feet of clay, and we need to be able to acknowledge that. I think the balance is highly desirable in the writing of anyone, and perhaps most of all Churchill. You know, you can certainly put him on a pedestal, but I think it's always desirable to say, well, yeah, he didn't get everything right all the time, but the flip side is it's equally the case that, you know, he wasn't a complete disaster too. Not that too many people want to say that these days, or indeed ever have.
Well, with that observation, Dr. Clues, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Dr. Clues.
Thank you very much.